Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joe Hagan, a contributing editor at New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Men's Journal. He began at New York Magazine in 2006 after working as a staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal, where he was part of the team that covered the Valerie Plame CIA leak case. He spent the preceding years as a columnist for The New York Observer, working under legendary editor Peter Kaplan and breaking a series of stories on Dan Rather's travails at CBS News. He has an article at the Texas Monthly, Dan Rather Was Right About George W. Bush. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Hagan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Let me just start by saying that the title of the story is Truth or Consequences.
Oh, I see.
There's some people have been reporting it as Dan Rather Was Right About George Bush, but that's not exactly what I say in the story.
Okay, well, it's what happens when you print out your story from the Texas Monthly.
Go ahead.
Answer that question then. Was Dan Rather right?
Well, he was right about some things. Now, his report in 2004, as you'll recall, came during a presidential election between Senator John Kerry and George Bush, and one of the main sort of political debates at the time was who had the credibility to continue the wage in command to the Iraq War, which was going very badly at the time. And so this began to revolve around whether, you know, Kerry's service in Vietnam versus George W. Bush's, what was he doing during Vietnam, and did he get preferential treatment to get into the National Guard? Was he dodging the draft? And then did he bail out of his service and go AWOL? These were the questions. Dan Rather reported two things. He had a man on who claimed to have gotten Bush in to the Guard in 1968 as a favor to the Bush family. And then he also had a second part to his report with these documents that said that, you know, Bush's commanding officers had come under some pressure to sugarcoat his record because he did not actually fulfill his duties. So this was the controversial part of the report. What I can say is that did Bush get some preferential treatment to get into the Guard in 68? I show in my story, I get really deep into this, that there was no way he could have gotten into the Guard when he did and how he did without some kind of influence, but that's the way it worked. In the next National Guard in Texas, it was a corrupt, good old boy system, and you had to, get a particular man to sign off on it. And this man was very political and was, treated it as a bottleneck. Then the next second part of the question becomes: why did he stop flying his airplane prematurely? He was an Air Force, an Air National Guard pilot, and did he disappear for a year? Well, these can't be answered definitively. I would say that the memos that CBS used are certainly dubious. I would not have trusted them. There's a lot of big problems with them, and if you put a gun to my head, I'd say they're fake. They can't be proved beyond a shadow of a doubt because they are Xerox copies. Forensics experts like to take ink samples and be able to say, I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt, this is from a certain era. But what we can know is that there's these serious gaps in Bush's record that have never been explained, that he has never explained. And there's pretty strong circumstantial evidence. There are two pieces of evidence that suggest that Bush stopped flying his airplane because he could no longer land it, that he began to have trouble flying it, that he was becoming unfocused as a pilot, and that his commanders may have decided that he was no longer fit to fly, and allowed him to, transfer and go into a different status.
But it remains, I suppose, and somewhat ironically so, that where George Bush's perhaps his biggest vulnerability at that time, in a race that he only won by 2 points in the pivotal state of Ohio against John Kerry, was that John Kerry was a war hero. There were doubts about George W. Bush's Vietnam War record and the Champagne Squadron that you mentioned, and the favorite son treatment, and all the, and the lost year, etc. At the end of the day, somehow Karl Rove took away John Kerry's being a hero, and right. Dan Rather and however this thing worked out, which is what the heart of your story is, managed to get rid of Bush's greatest vulnerability.
Well, that's true. And here's why I wrote the story and why I think it's interesting. first of all, my whole thesis in the story is like that, you know, and it's true that Dan Rather's downfall was the cork in the story. You know, you could never really return to the story again. They, as I put it in the story, they made Dan Rather's reputation became the tombstone of this story. But the story, I wanted to just sort of put aside the controversy of CBS and those memos and say, well, what do we know that's true? What is the real story about what happened to Bush? And how did this story come to be? And I tell the whole backstory of it, and it's a very deep and wild tale. I mean, the more I got into it, the weirder and more interesting it became, which is why I wrote the story. And why I think it's important is because, you know, Bush's presidential library is going to be opening next year. And this part of his biography is very, I think, very important to understanding him as a president and his political persona. You'll recall that in 2003, he landed in a jet airplane on the aircraft carrier under the banner Mission Accomplished. And this was seen as a great political mistake and kind of a terrible irony because the war sort of descended into a bloody quagmire after that. But obviously, this was a part of his political image, that he was this stud pilot. And so this story about what actually happened to him during those years and whether he was actually somebody who was avoiding combat and who actually couldn't fly his plane, you know, these are questions that are worth asking because they strike at amazingly profound ironies.
But can't you say, though, Joe Hagan, again, contributing editor at New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Men's Journal, and the author of an article at the Texas Monthly, again, what's the correct title?
Truth or Consequences.
Truth or Consequences. The long and the short of it is that the last year is, I think, by definition, a lost year because you can't get any information about it. I mean, isn't...
Well, here's what we can know, and I went as deep as you can get into this without going crazy, which is there are documents. You can only go by documents and with eyewitnesses to tell you what happened 30-odd years ago, 40 years ago. There's a document in his record that by his commanding officer, they allowed him to transfer away from his home base for a year to go work on a Senate campaign that his dad had set him up in. He stopped flying. He lost his flight status by failing to take a flight physical, which under normal circumstances would have sparked an investigation, and they would have had to look into why did this pilot throw away his status as a pilot. Well, that never happened. And there were no paper records showing that when he went away to another state, Alabama in this case, to work on this campaign, that he filed for a transfer and was supposed to be continuing his duty there for that full year. Well, there are no paper, there's no paper trail showing he did any duty while he was away for that year. There are no credible eyewitnesses who can say, I saw him serving. Nobody ever saw him serve. There are no papers that show him serving. So that was the basis of the investigation into the lost year. What was he doing during this year? And what I found is, you know, in 2004, the Bush White House did put out these computerized pay records they suddenly dug up that showed that he had supposedly served some dates in Alabama where he was, you know, during this lost year. However, there's problems with those dates, and that's what I circled around. So what you end up coming down to, the bottom line here is, there is no credible explanation for all the conflicting data about what he was doing. Nobody ever saw him. There were rewards put out. If you ever saw George Bush serving in Alabama in 1972, we'll give you $50,000. Okay, nobody collected that money. There was another reward for $10,000 by the author of Doonesbury, the cartoon. Not collected. And these dates, as I said, that he supposedly was paid for service in Alabama, he was actually living in Houston at the time. So that makes no sense whatsoever. So there's like these conflicting things. There's a mystery that remains there. And I spoke with an ex-girlfriend of his who said she never saw him in Alabama again. You know, she would have known had he been in Alabama serving during these dates because, you know, she was dating him. So, you know, there's problems here and there's something not right and it remains something of a mystery there, but or a black hole. But the fact is that post all of this, I will say that some very credible, high-up former Air Force commanders and generals have looked at his records and say, well, based on what his records, he should not have you know, he did not fulfill his duty. You know, that there was not the way he served did not qualify as fulfillment. But his officers down at the time, you know, this was a very sort of like a good old boy, kind of highly corrupt and politicized National Guard in Texas in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, they looked the other way. Now, this is like a garden variety story for sons of wealth at this time. This is not like a big controversy. It only becomes a controversy 30 years later, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, they just did the paperwork the way they had to do it to make it okay for him. And this was not like illegal or nefarious. It just was what it was. Now, when you put it into a political lens and you're talking about the President of the United States and a man who starts a major war in the Middle East, well, it becomes, has high political metaphorical value. And that's what my story delves into in a really kind of a deeper way than I think has been done before.
So, Joe Hagan, let's get into the 60 Minutes side of it and how they,
sure.
A lot of people felt that it was a sort of gray operation in terms of almost a sting in a way, that
right.
that these Xerox documents didn't have the right fonts for the time,
right.
and the right-wing blogosphere immediately seemed to seize upon it. 60 Minutes went, just before they went to air, they showed the memos to the White House, and Dan Bartlett at the White House basically didn't say that they were no good,
right.
And that has led a lot of people to assume that was a kind of a setup, that
right.
Bartlett was baiting the trap for them, that this was, you know, yet another example of the genius of the nefarious Karl Rove. So walk us through that.
Well, a lot of people came to believe that, including, you know, a lot of people in the CBS universe. Believed that. But a lot of things were believed about this story. One of the things that happened with the Bush National Guard story is over the 15 years that it was a political item, starting when he was governor in Texas, it began to kind of collect a lot of conspiracy theories around it. It became very muddied by opportunists and cranks who wanted to be involved and prove something about that story, including the man who gave those documents to CBS, who was a man who had a very sort of dubious history with this story. He had been claiming since the late 90s that he witnessed Bush aides scrubbing, or throwing away pieces of Bush's record to clean it up, so to speak. And he had become kind of like enmeshed in this story and was the man who, you know, 6 years after he makes that claim, gives them to CBS.
This is Bill Burkett, the West Texas rancher who claims
right.
that he got these documents at a cattle show in Houston.
Right. Well, that's an explanation he came up with after he told lots of other explanations.
Right. Well, that's pretty bizarre.
Some people thought he had been duped. You know, other people thought he was the duper. And, you know, again, that is a dead-end trail because nobody can get, you know, Burkett will never talk about, you know, he claims all he knows is what he knows, that he would, you know, given these by some shady characters.
In terms of muddying the water, before Dan Rather muddied the water and paid the ultimate price, this
right.
fellow Hatfield released a book through St. Martin's Press, and
right.
then it was revealed that he himself had served 5 years in prison for hiring a hitman to kill a former
right.
colleague, and he later committed suicide. So,
right.
again, George W. Bush is rescued by those who
right.
who were trying to...
Well, you know, a lot of people aren't going to want to hear this, but, you know, I'm an investigative reporter by trade, and a lot of what I'm paid to do is to, you know, investigate these theories and then either follow them
sure.
or disprove them.
Well, we have to wrap it up.
Let me just give you the sad news is that, you know, it was like a lot of kind of very feverish Democrats who drove a lot of the conspiracies around this and helped Bush by creating all of these wacky theories that ended up that Dan Rather became a victim of. Now, that's his fault.
Right.
But he got enmeshed in these conspiracy theories when the truth was already out there. I mean,
and the truth was bad enough in itself.
It was just already there. Yeah, but Walter Robinson of the Boston Globe had done a massive investigation on this.
Well, thank you for joining us, Joe Hagan. I'm sorry we've run out of time. Again, Joe Hagan, contributing editor at the New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Men's Journal, and he is the author of this article currently at the Texas Monthly. Truth and Consequences. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Yeah.